There's no place to escape to.
This is the last
podcast on the left.
From your glaze.
That's when the cannibalism started.
You know, mostly I like episodes that encourage people to show their breasts.
Ooh.
You know,
you're getting it done right up top, aren't you?
Oh, yeah.
Boobies. Male, female, dog.
I really wish more of our material. I'll see a dog's tits.
I know you will.
Yeah.
You know, I
see dog's tits every day of my life.
He loves to. And he loves every second of it.
Uh-huh.
And the many pictures. Hey,
Georgie, it's time for your mandatory belly rub.
Yeah. I give her belly rubs all the time. She's a little girl, so she has tits.
And you are the one who's saying stop sexualizing corgis.
Oh.
Georgie's tits are for Georgie's babies that she's not having.
That's right.
I actually have some big news from the Kissel household, but I don't want to hear your humor about it. But we'll start the show first.
What do you want to share?
Big news in the Kissel household. Jerry now comes when I call him. And no, he doesn't ejaculate.
You did that again.
No, that was, I went to sleep thinking, oh, Henry's gonna, if I say Jerry comes when I call him, Henry's gonna be like, oh, he ejaculates.
Wow.
So I nullified that.
He has really been taking and assuming my reactions recently.
I'm ChatGPT for you.
I think the word projection is coming to mind.
I'm feeling
the word projection. I'm feeling some projection.
Because today's episode's all about how breasts need to be covered. This is about hiding tits.
Protected.
Protect
Let's say
your
protected.
Tits.
All right. Welcome to the last podcast on the left, Ben, hanging out with Marcus, hanging out with Henry, and the newly, this new philosophy.
I'm mature.
That breasts need to be covered as opposed to revealed for the world to see.
I mean, normally, show them, flop them out. I want to see them. I want to see other people sucking on your tits. If you want to get rid of your own breasts, great. You could do whatever you want to them.
I'm personally in a bit of a breast renaissance right now because I've been watching a lot of 70s movies. I watched this movie, The Vampire Happening, the other night that I absolutely adored.
Nice.
No less 15 to 20 pairs of breasts in that movie. Yep. I watched this movie with Donald Pleasance called The Mutations.
Great.
Three pairs of breasts in that movie.
It's incredible.
1970s update to Freaks, and yet they still managed to put three pairs of breasts in it.
You know what bumped to the top of my looking at boobs search list recently? Mm-hmm. Tawny Katane.
Interesting.
There you go. Well, isn't that exciting?
What but a this great episode.
This episode. Yeah. How does it tie into the episode?
I just got to get it out. I have to just understand that this. A lot of this episode, I'm going to be forced to be silent.
Okay, yes. Good.
By Marcus.
Wow. Right?
Because a lot of this involves really intense breast attacks.
Oh.
And not in a way I like a breast attack, which is six, three angles coming in and go, oh, I wake up going,
whoa.
You know, like, that's a fun breast attack.
Yeah.
But this is the opposite of that.
Yeah. You got to pay double for that. All right, today's episode, you want a blood? Well, you're going to get it. The Chicago Rippers.
Remember, you asked for this.
You asked for it.
The Chicago Rippers, a.k.a. the Ripper Crew, were a gang of four psychopaths who murdered up to 20 women in Chicago over the course of just a year and a half during the early 80s in a criminally underreported and largely forgotten crime spree.
I think it's largely underreported because it's extremely unpleasant and it is most of it can't even be portrayed on television.
No.
Oh, so you're sitting there, you're alone right now, and you have to remind yourself, even these guys had friends. So get out there and find your own Ripper Crew, but make it like about bowling.
Yeah.
We're the Ripper Crew. We play pool.
When I meet the Chicago Ripper Crew, I hope it's a bunch of guys who all like fart songs.
Oh, that's polka farts.
That would be incredible. But this, again, opposite.
Okay.
Now, Ripper cases are so named because they share features with the infamous Jack the Ripper case of 1888. That is to say, they usually involve the extreme mutilations of sex workers.
Yeah.
But while Jack the Ripper is arguably the most famous serial killer to ever exist, and Peter Sutcliffe, the Yorkshire Ripper, he's been burned into the British consciousness since the early 80s, the Chicago Rippers, they hold no such distinction in even local history.
Yeah, Chicago doesn't want to claim them.
Mm-mm.
Weird.
See, Jack the Ripper gets his place in the history books because he was the first modern serial killer. And the Yorkshire Ripper case only got serious investigative power after Peter Sutcliffe started murdering members of so-called polite society, non-sex workers.
Right.
The Chicago Rippers, however, focused mostly, but not exclusively, on sex workers, which makes the lack of press coverage during and after the murders both baffling and predictable.
I also want to say this. There's nothing more polite than sucking somebody off when they're stressed.
Seriously.
And so thank you, sex workers. Thank you for keeping all of those South Dakota farmers when they go to Vegas for that weekend.
Yeah.
Thank you for stopping them from murdering their family for 3 years when you stomp on their balls.
It's incredible the work that you do, and it's unfortunate the way these people come at you. And I think we brought this up recently.
Yeah. Don't come at me with that.
Don't come at me with that.
Learn that, sex workers. Embrace it.
Yeah. They know that.
Well, out of the 20-some-odd killed by the Chicago Rippers, 4 weren't sex workers. 1, however, wasn't a woman and was killed in a random shooting. But 3 were still the sorts of victims who usually get both press and police attention, secretaries and the like, not to mention the fact that they were white women. And to that point, perhaps the reason why there wasn't such a massive sense of urgency was that the vast majority of the victims in the Chicago Rippers case were black sex workers, who historically have the least amount of investigative power placed into their murder investigations.
We talked about that for years.
This process of looking for the Chicago Ripper crew was decidedly lazy, and they weren't caught if it wasn't for a piece of truly just luck was how they were caught. But thankfully they were, because these are the part of also why I think after the fact that these were not reported, because we brought up because these crimes are particularly very, very grisly, but also because the men themselves that committed these crimes, what we most know, most of what we know, we've talked about this before, about any serial killer comes from the mouths of the serial killer themselves.
Can't trust them.
Trying to put together, but mostly it's because they're, what do we know about serial killers? A lot of their narcissistic tendencies means they want to be in charge of their own storyline.
They want to be on the cover of the Rolling Stone.
Yes, and they want everybody to know their version of the story. These guys have not spoken about these crimes, and they've also have not admitted that they even did these crimes ever. They have sort of, you'll get to it. Because they all roll back, because they roll back,
but 3 of them get very extensive with their confessions.
Well, that's how we know anything. But then after the fact, they're all still saying that they're extremely innocent. And talk about extreme. They're like, no, XXX innocent.
XXX innocent. And of course, when it comes to rolling back, we do have to remember Walmart.
Yep.
Still rolling back prices to this day.
Yep.
I mean, destroying our society. But
at the very least, the ringleader of the Chicago Rippers never admitted to anything and is still never admitted to doing anything untoward despite mountains.
No, and I'm just so happy.
Eyewitness reports. No physical evidence, mind you, but eyewitness evidence.
And I'm just so happy that Samwise was able there to help the ringleader towards the very end when he was like, I don't think I can kill this woman.
Samwise
was like, you can kill this woman. I'll carry you.
Oh, we'll kill her for you. And this is where you're really important here today, Kizzle.
Levity. I'm bringing the levity.
You're bringing the levity. And also like that your Frodo was Italian. I don't think I can do it.
Honestly, Frodo's a very Italian name.
It does sound like a pasta. Yeah.
But I'm kind of taking it back or even to doing this because I'm having a hard time kind of concentrating on anything since the loss of Gordon Lightfoot.
I know you've been quite devastated.
If you could read my mind, would a tear so would tear.
He also mentions Wisconsin and the wreck of the Edmund Fitzgerald.
Until this day, I didn't know how many of my friends were Gordon Lightfoot fans.
We're Lightfoot heads.
I'm a Lightfoot head for sure. I thought he was dead. Otherwise, I would have seen him.
Sundown was like, that's how Natalie knew to avoid me during quarantine.
When you listen to Sundown,
she'd hear like Sundown. When you heard that coming out of my office, she just didn't. She knew, don't go in there.
That's half a bottle of whiskey right there. And then a cigar that he has one puff of, but then he's like, it makes me a little sick.
Well, as we've said again and again, because it bears repeating, black sex workers, especially in the 80s and 90s, they were the ones most likely to have the letters DNI scrawled on their body bags, meaning do not investigate. And if there's no investigation, there's usually no coverage. And as it was, because the investigation and the media attention was so relatively scant during the Chicago Ripper murders, the team of 4 psychopaths who perpetrated these crimes operated with near impunity with a horrific glee throughout.
All right, so we got to ask Kansas BTK Hot Dog Squad. We're in Chicago here, the Bratwurst Boys. How bad were these cops? Were they as bad as the Hot Dog Squad?
No, well, the Hot Dog Squad.
At least there was a squad dedicated to the BTK's crimes.
They tried. They very much tried. This was like
I guess tried
pure,
and failed. But
they at least There was no task force.
Okay.
No, there was not. Yeah, because some of the hot dog squad guys like died with the BTK folder on their nightstand.
Okay.
Like that did never gave up.
I mean,
it
was covered in mustard. It was mostly, yeah, it was keeping the water rings from getting on their nice furniture.
You don't want that to happen.
Well, the Chicago Rippers would remove breasts with piano wire and have sex with the wounds either before or after they tortured the victims with homemade implements, and it was always done in a mobile chamber of horrors that took the form of a customized red Dodge van.
Ooh, man, can
bit
you imagine?
Of a toy box killer vibes with that.
Just being around Robin Gecht and even just seeing a grand piano, and it's like, I could cut a lot of tits off of that.
Right.
Thing. Mm-hmm. Right. Like, well, he can really fit. And then if he saw a harp.
Oh, he'd go crazy.
He'd be like, oh, I don't have anything to dissemble. I don't have to dissemble it. Yeah. It's right there. I can go, oh, look at that. You just go walk by fast.
Sounds like our business manager there. Well, that's good. Have you seen Active Killing, that documentary from back in the day?
Yeah, yeah.
I learned that you could kill a lot of people with piano wire, and I didn't know that. I mean, I knew it, but I didn't really know it.
And the mob uses it, too.
Yeah. Yes.
But we know about the victims and what happened to them because 3 out of the 4 Chicago Rippers copped to the murders during the investigation.
75%?
75% ain't bad. Ain't bad. That ain't bad. The ringleader, however, never confessed, meaning that it is highly likely that his body count is much higher.
I utterly, utterly believe that Robin Gecht did a lot more than what he said.
That was his name. His name was Robin Gecht.
Very sissy name.
It's a straight Gecht.
Yeah, he's one of those guys where, like, even as I'm trying to, like, joke around about him and going in for information about him, this guy is in the world of the villains gallery of serial killers. He is in the top echelon when it comes to mean and stupid. He's an extremely bad guy.
Yeah,
right. That's funny. That's a funny term because I don't really think of Jeffrey Dahmer as mean. Well, I think of him as meek and weak and then scared and then horrible.
Well, that's the whole thing, is that with serial killers, the cliche is, oh, he was always so quiet. Oh, you would never know. We never knew Dennis Rader was BTK. We never knew that Jeffrey Dahmer was keeping all these people in his apartment. Right. With Robin Gecht, he was mean and fucked up and cruel 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Constantly to everyone around him.
With the name Robin, tends to be a little bit more feminine. I wonder if it's a boy named Sue situation.
I mean, there is. It is. It's psychologically obvious the way he does his crimes.
Yeah.
Like, that's the thing, is that you're talking about, you know, they always kind of
really
have
on the
about,
nose. Yeah.
It's super on the nose. It's hack.
Right.
And that, of all the things that make me upset about this story,
I know.
That's the top.
I know.
It's been like, no creativity. Unbelievable.
I mean, it does sound like there was some.
Show, not tell.
Great call. Great call.
But before we get into the story of Robin Gecht and his Ripper crew, great band name.
Sure. Yes. Jesse and the Rippers.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Wow. Yeah.
Is that from Full House?
Full House, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
This is all I thought of.
Wow.
It's like, I just see Jesse in his, like, he had to do that weird genie outfit because they turned the song that was like a super sweet song, they turned into a dance, like, clip, and then he had to do a music video, and he's like, they're selling me out, they're selling us out, you know? Mm-hmm. I remember.
I do remember that.
Robin Gecht and the Ripper Crew. Sounds like a great, like, early, mid-60s Liverpool band.
Just seeing Robin Gecht next to the Beach Boys.
That's a match made in schizophrenic hell, yeah.
Well, let's acknowledge our source today before we get into the story. For this two-part series, we have Deadly Thrills by J. Slade Fletcher.
Deadly Thrills! It was very deeply in the world of traditional 1990s true crime.
This is classic old school true crime supermarket paperback. It's written by a cop. It's got everything you want.
Great.
If I remember correctly, it was actually sent to us many years ago by listener Jessica Shannon, because this book is actually very, very rare.
Oh.
Jessica, by the way, still runs an awesomely curated morbid subreddit at r/JessicaMShannon.
So okay.
Check it out if you does a great job moderating. Great job.
Be nice.
Be nice.
Please be nice.
Please
be nice. That job is thankless and almost impossible.
Yeah. I also, we'll just say up top, it's a gold star episode.
Yeah.
Oh, so, yeah. We've already done a lot of tit chopping, like just jokes, and it's going to continue.
Yeah. Well, it's going to get detailed at multiple points over the next two episodes. So
they were mostly just breast related. I don't think they were about the chopping.
No. But it's I need to get it out. I have to figure out a way to get it out in a way that's constructive, entertaining,
creative.
Yeah. Creative.
Yes.
Well, an overdue thank you to Jessica. And so without further ado, let's get to the story of Robin Gecht and the Ripper Crew. Robin Gecht, it sounds like a little frog, like a toad man.
I just hate the way it works.
Yeah. Well, it's also sad because I hate the fucking the way the cops put this too, where they're like, it's about little man syndrome. Robin Gecht was 5'7".
Well, we'll get into that.
Oh,
all right.
Interesting.
He was the tall one.
We'll get into that.
He was the tall one.
Yeah. And I think it's interesting how much umbrage you take with that.
It really is.
We're going to get into that later.
Marcus never said anything about, oh, Jack the Ripper is so thin and so British.
He was
British.
The unknown. We didn't know who he was.
Yeah. Well, Marcus hasn't complained about
that. I mean, Jack the Ripper was certainly a thin, lithe, quick man.
I did have some anger towards the Ed Kemper episode.
Oh, of course.
So I understand. Yeah.
So Robin Gecht was born in Chicago in 1953 into a classic hard luck serial killer environment that never let up during his entire childhood. Thank you.
That's right. You said, I'm not woke. I'm not woke. I'm not woke. Woke.
The only love Robin ever got was from his grandmother, Sarah, who doted upon her grandchild by saying, quote,
"You are my first grandchild. That makes you special."
Well, that's nice.
Yeah.
That was the only time anything ever nice was ever said.
If you can get the grandmother on your side, though, you have the whole house.
Who cares? Your fucking pussy's already done. She already did her shit-ass work back in the day.
No, that's not about that.
If you remember, Ted Bundy had the grandfather. That didn't work out too well.
It didn't.
No, it's about the grandmother.
I see. But unfortunately, Robin was treated as far less than special throughout his formative years.
Yeah, it was kind of more of a joke.
I see.
His brother Everett was born 3 years after Robin, and his sister Rochelle came 2 years after that. And since the Gecht home was so small, Robin lost his bed to his two younger siblings and had to sleep on the floor. Soon after, his parents abandoned him to the, he'll figure it out on his own school of parenting that often leads to, let's say, bad habits.
It leads to me. And I think it's fantastic.
What are you talking about? Your mother didn't leave you to your mother actively took you out of school and took you to the Piggly Wiggly. Did she pet your hair?
No. She never pet my hair.
You were raised for a period of time.
Yeah.
I was raised. I'm just saying, yes, I'm a mama's boy. Yes, me and my mom, I can go to Piggly Wiggly right now. I can get you all the bag cereal you want. But what I'm saying is,
you're coming straight to, you immediately want to support Robin Gecht.
No, I don't.
You immediately
no,
are
I'm
trying
not.
To
I am just
like,
saying,
apologize for Robin
when
Gecht,
parents,
one of the worst serial killers of all time.
No. I'm just right saying, now, sometimes when parents are a little bit more hands-off, their kids become podcasters or artists or maybe CEOs. And it's not his parents' fault that he became a serial killer.
I'm starting to notice a bit of a pattern. You really do fall on the side of the serial killers who like to murder in cars. Isn't that interesting?
I it's cars. Maybe it's because he's a truck guy.
I'm a Chevy guy. Yeah, I was hanging out with my high school buddy. He's like, when did you become a Chevy guy? I was like, you don't remember? Guy. I don't think so, buddy. I was like, oh, yeah.
All of our cars equally represent us because you drive a car of a House of Representative member from North Dakota. You have a lesbian school mother's car, and my car is of a tiny, fat producer.
A Subaru Outback is a very versatile vehicle.
It's for women that look like Elizabeth Warren and their beekeeper wives.
A versatile vehicle for a diverse group of people.
Absolutely fantastic. And of course, I do love your new bumper sticker that says, cross the picket line, WGA.
Yeah, hashtag scab artist.
Live from your grave.
Now, it was perhaps Robin's increasing resentment towards his new siblings combined with his own natural sociopathic tendencies that led to his first experience with death, which also said quite a bit about the attentiveness of his parents or lack thereof.
Pointed.
I'm saying, okay.
When Robin was 6, he, his mother, and his siblings took a trip to the grocery store. And while Robin's mother went inside with Robin's infant sister, she told Robin to stay outside to watch his 3-year-old brother, even though Robin was only 6.
See, white trash is international.
No, but
it's
this
thing
is
where if you are, because that is such a thing of taking a 6-year-old and being like, hey, watch a 3-year-old. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's double H.
You're figuring it out.
Yeah. That's a double up. I think that's okay.
What?
It was the 60s.
He's completely well, a different child. He's neglected.
Yeah.
He's searching for his mother still in many different environments. Yeah. He goes to the basketball men and he wants them to be his mother. He wants the wings to be his mother.
I just follow that sweet, sweet sound of giggling.
He beat.
Shut up.
You're beat.
I did it.
Now, it's unknown whether Robin let events unfold or whether he pushed them along. But pretty soon, his little brother Everett had wandered out into the street and got hit by a car. What do you think about that now,
Not
Ben?
Good.
Not good.
My older brother saved me from getting hit by a car because I was darting into traffic, grabbed me by the shirt, and pulled me back. So he was not a good older brother.
He was not.
No.
Everett survived with permanent brain damage.
Yeah, but he was the fine one.
No, he got sent to an institution
because
the Gecht family was too poor to take care of him at home, and he never returned. He just got popped into the there.
One of those.
Probably in the 80s, if he survived till then, just got thrown out into the street.
We used to call it the CRISPR.
Put him in the CRISPR.
Yeah.
But technically, he's lucky. Everett? I know that he's at least he doesn't have to be known as the brother of right. Robin Gecht, and he just gets to go and kind of rock back and forth in a room someplace else.
Well, perhaps to fill the Everett-sized hole in their lives, or perhaps because the Gechts were just too fucking stupid to stop, they gave birth to another child in 1961, Julia, and another
child. It feels too good to come inside,
but you gotta wait. You get to do it a couple times a month, and that needs to be good enough if you're not going to be on birth control.
I also had no fetish for it.
It's not a fetish. It's just pretty. It's just good.
I'm just saying, like, having it. It's just having the many children. It's very stressful.
Yeah, it's just stressful.
Well, after Julia in 1961, there was another, Joanne, in 1964. And it therefore became Robin's job to take care of all these little girls who seemed to come in an endless stream.
Uh-oh.
Robin then had to shoulder even more responsibility when his beloved grandmother died of stomach cancer and his father became ill with an unnamed, quote-unquote, blood ailment.
Diseases used to be simpler.
Yeah.
Yeah, the big problem with the blood.
He's got blood. There's something wrong with his blood.
That's all you know?
And this was all before Robin was 10 years old.
So there's a lot going on.
Now, while I don't want to get too much into armchair psychology here, it seems to me that Robin's early experiences with the female gender was seen mostly by him as a heavy burden. Robin's entire life revolved around the care of girls. And while most men come out of this experience with a deeper appreciation for women.
Or as I say, a very healthy amount of fear, which has really helped me be surrounded by women.
Yeah. A feminine touch, you might say. I think Robin's inborn psychopathic tendencies brought about the opposite effect. Instead of love, Robin engendered nothing but hate towards women.
I also, just the straight up of kind of this system. He's become a little mini parent, but I've seen a lot of people come from this environment.
Yeah.
And they didn't start the Chicago Ripper.
That's what I mean, inborn psychopathic tendencies.
Sometimes they start record labels.
Sometimes.
You know what I mean?
There's just something about his height.
That's what it is. But again, it's supposed to fuel your personality.
I think also being his height, he's smaller than a lot of women or eye to eye. You know, so maybe he, anyway, that's the whole thing. But you know what I've become with women? Neutral.
You know, that's nice.
You just sit away, not angry.
Neutral.
Yeah, you just sit away. You just sit at Big Wings.
Jerry comes when I call him.
Come.
Don't do it.
He's gonna, he comes all over his fucking ass.
Yeah, I figured he was going to do something like that.
Now, Robin was, of course, a problem child at school, always fighting, stealing, and starting fires, all of which would, of course, draw the ire of his father, who always, even though he couldn't work, he always seemed to manage to muster up enough energy to beat his son, despite his blood ailment.
I mean, it's all about
what you like to do.
Yeah, that's true. But when the school had enough of Robin's antisocial behavior, he was sent first to a day school for troubled juveniles. But when he refused to attend of his own volition, though, Robin was sent to a troubled teen school for 8 months. Now, almost certainly, Robin was sent to the Chicago Parental School with the rest of the city's so-called incorrigibles. But as far as troubled teen schools went, this wasn't one of the worst. I looked into the Chicago Parental School, mostly modeled after military school. No corporal punishment was ever allowed.
Yeah.
The worst punishment also isn't the best punishment. They would give kids 24 hours of solitary confinement in a well-lit, well-ventilated room. It's like more of a cool-off room.
That's not the worst I've ever heard.
Yeah, the crisper.
Yeah, the crisper.
The crisper.
Yeah.
Was Chucky there?
Chucky?
Part two! Chucky two!
No.
Military school!
Nope. Not at all. No, I'm so scared.
No, sorry.
Come. You could read my mind.
You were saying, Marcus?
They did have a school newspaper. It was called The Skipper.
Yeah. Yeah, they had the Gilligan, too, but that was mostly just recipes for onion soup.
That's actually great.
Yeah. But after 8 months at the parental school, Robin was brought home after his grandfather also died, and his aunt quickly followed her father with suicide because she lost both her parents in less than a year. It's, again, as I said, it's a hard luck serial killer story. It's just nothing but misery and death and pain.
I don't know. It sounds like you should have become a graffiti artist.
Very much
a designer. Yeah.
Yeah. It definitely sounds like this isn't child's play.
Oh, see, that's fine. Again, that's sort
the name of the
up.
Fucking
that's
movie.
Fine.
I was
the name of the movie.
Involving Chucky.
Yeah. Well, looking for some purpose in life, Robin, at the age of 15, began working with his dead grandfather's tools so he could learn enough electrical know-how to repair television sets.
That's incredible.
That's great.
Yeah, this is 1968. Television sets are on the fritz all the time.
He has literally 35 years of work ahead of him.
Yep. Yeah.
By the age of 18, he met a girl whom Deadly Thrills called Judy Carson.
Judy Carson. Yeah. Okay.
It's the first of many pseudonyms the author used to protect the innocent.
I see.
Judy gave birth to the first of Robin Geck's many children.
Oh, my
but
God.
Luckily for her, they broke up and she married someone else, leaving Robin far behind.
Great.
So after an extremely short-lived return home in which Robin was punched in the face by his father hours after his arrival.
He didn't want him there.
No.
Because he, again, Robin was a problem.
Robin was a problem. Robin was violent. Robin was mean. All the time.
Right.
You wonder why the first marriage dissolved because of that. Yeah. He was not very nice.
Sure. Yeah.
Robin, after that, drifted from woman to woman for years until he met and married 17-year-old Rosemary McCaffrey in 1975, when Robin was 22. The first child was born a year later, and two more children would be born between then and the year in which Robin was caught for the Ripper murders, 1982.
I wonder where these kids are. Do you know where his kids are?
No,
I don't think they would be like, that's not my dad.
Actually, yeah, I do know where one of his kids did get convicted of murder, and I think we're going to be covering that in the next episode.
Holy
so yeah, these
shit.
Kids did not come out.
They didn't come out gray?
Could be genetic.
Oh, is it the batter?
Yeah.
It might be the batter. Something like that's what I was like. A bad pizza starts with the dough.
That is true. Well,
A bad pizza starts with the water. That's what I say.
Yeah, that's the cum.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's Robin Geck's
cum. That's why I've accepted that.
And the flour pizza, is the eggs.
That's why pizza, bagels, bread, and coffee in Los Angeles aren't very good because the water here is bad.
But you know, you can get a Chicago style from a spot called Gino's, which is close to Chicago.
Yeah, honestly, the bread can be good.
Yeah, the bread.
It can be. If they use filtered bread. If they use tap water, you can
tell. This is where you're showing some of your bias, but we'll get you around.
It's okay.
Now, one of the most bizarre coincidences in the Robin Geck story came from his choice of profession, electrician.
Hmm.
And it comes from who he met as a result of that career choice.
The cable guy.
Yeah, Jim Carrey. Features heavily in this.
Wow.
Yep. Somebody stop me.
That's a really
no one would.
That's from The Mask, though. So.
That's all they needed.
That's all they knew.
Yeah.
See, Robin had learned the basics of home repair from his uncle, Roger, and he therefore opened his own electrical repair business by 1975. He moved on from TVs. He moved up to homes.
Wow.
Remember, this is Chicago during the late 70s. So if you're doing small-time work that involves working with contractors, then there's a chance that you might have worked with PDM and its CEO, John Wayne Gacy.
Whoa.
Now,
I thought we were going mob route.
No,
I didn't
dude.
Know we were going John Wayne Gacy.
John Wayne Gacy. This is we'll see because we're like, where was there involvement?
Now, well, let's unpack it a little bit.
Yeah.
Now, there's no evidence whatsoever that John Wayne Gacy and Robin Geck ever killed together because why would they? John Wayne Gacy killed men in his home and Robin Geck killed women in his van. Additionally, Gacy was caught in 1978. Robin's murders didn't begin until 1981, or at least provably didn't begin until 1981.
But okay. Now I believe it is a fact that John Wayne Gacy had accomplices. We don't know who these accomplices are. We don't know whether or not those accomplices also ended up buried in the fucking basement along with the other victims. And we would not know that some of those victims might have been one of his accomplices. But again, tenuous.
I
think if you get murdered, you're no longer an accomplice. You become
a victim. You have graduated to victim.
Yeah, you have.
Well, interestingly, they did know each other. They absolutely knew each other.
This is why I'm saying.
Well, I mean, we'll get to that in a second, but Gecht was almost called as a witness during John Wayne Gacy's trial.
He's on the books having been hired by PDM contractors.
Oh.
So he was there at some point. But again, in what aspect?
In what aspect?
Because John Wayne Gacy, could he see that Robin Gecht had, was he a little bit too fucked up to even be an accomplice? Is it a guy that you look at this guy and like, oh, this guy's kind of fucked up?
Too rogue.
We also talk about, John Wayne Gacy mostly would kind of float. So sometimes guys like to relieve each other of their little stresses, right?
Like used
to
do that thing.
Yeah. And I don't know whether Robin Gecht was like, I like tits.
Yeah. I would imagine if I were to speculate as to why Robin Gecht may have been brought in, I would say it was probably because John Wayne Gacy killed a lot of his own employees. And since Robin Gecht worked with John Wayne Gacy,
they just went through the Rolodex.
Worked with John Wayne Gacy, he might have been collected. Maybe this guy knows something about an employee that disappeared at a certain point in time. Something like, I think it's just a fucking incredible coincidence.
Maybe something to do with the Polish Day Parade.
Maybe
Gecht was organizing all the marching for the Polish
Day
Parade.
It turns out he did it on Italian's Day.
Weird.
Now, Henry, I know you're a staunch believer in the theory that John Wayne Gacy had accomplices to the point where you just said it is now proved that
proven
he had accomplices.
Fact.
Although it's not a proven fact.
In the court of Zabrowski.
That's the court of Z.
Yeah. I'm not so. I still believe it's speculation.
Okay. Yeah, sure. I do believe that it's just more likely than not that serial killers with extremely high body counts have some form of accomplices, as we've seen with Dean Corll. I think that John Wayne Gacy is very similar. As we know for a fact that Henry Lee Lucas was trained by the CIA in order to destabilize the American system.
The hand of death is completely real.
It sounds to me like
you have your jump to conclusions, Matt. Out,
it's
and
a
you
jump to conclusions
are yeah. jumping to conclusions.
But what's surprising to me when people talk about the Gacy accomplice theory is that no one ever brings up the fact that Robin Gecht did exactly what Gacy was supposed to have done. And he did it in the exact same city at nearly the exact same time.
I mean, it's a great environment for self-starters.
Yeah.
I guess so.
Yeah. The Ripper crew was made up of Robin Gecht and the younger employees at his construction business, Eddie Spetzer, and the Cocorellis brothers, Andy and Tommy.
And if there wasn't a bigger bunch of winners you've ever met in your life, it's these incredible young men.
Wow.
Because Andy and Tommy could both together tie one pair of shoes.
Well, that's not bad.
But this thing, if you're looking for accomplices, maybe this is John Wayne Gacy knew.
Mm-hmm.
You got to go for real stupid.
You got to go for stupid, but capable.
Stupid, well, capable in a way that they're really good at murdering women and helping you murder women.
Well, that would be what the job calls for in these cases, wouldn't it?
Well, this is how all these guys met. Robin and his wife Rosemary were neighbors with the Cocorellis brothers, who came from a Greek Orthodox family ruled by a violent tyrant who would lash his children after he tied them shirtless to a table. Usually he did this for such paltry transgressions as smoking a little weed. You get 15 lashes for smoking weed.
Whoa, I better smoke some weed to make that not hurt so much.
Now, we don't know exactly how Andy and Tommy were roped into Robin Gecht's life, but it's likely that Robin simply offered them jobs working as handymen at Robin's company.
They were neighbors.
Yeah, they were neighbors. Yeah, sure. You need some work, come work. And they
you got it, Robin. I can't wait.
I mean, that's 90% of it, just being in the right spot.
That's right, yeah.
And you saw them outside chopping up a couple of melons.
Uh-huh. Yep.
And he's like, you're perfect for what I need you for.
Yeah, and he also babysat, they also babysat his kids.
Oh, that's good.
It's a really large number of serial killers who were also babysitters.
Hey, again, it's really You don't need a lot of references.
Yep. Nope. The Adventures of Babysitting XXX. What?
So Jeffrey Epstein was making on the island.
Oh, no, no. You know, we're close with him. It's Jeff. Yeah.
But didn't Noam Chomsky write that?
You got him.
Well, around 1978 or 1979, the timeline is pretty vague on this one. Okay. The fourth member of the Ripper crew arrived. See, Tommy and Andy Cocorellis had a sister, and she had a boyfriend named Eddie Spetzer. After 15 months of dating, though, the Cocorellis sister moved away and broke up with Eddie. Mm. And Eddie, soon after, also lost his job at an auto parts store.
But the best part thing is, your relationship, when people break up, you get the other guy, right?
Yeah.
So it's nice because in the divorce, we got Eddie.
Isn't that nice? They got Eddie. Does he look like Eddie from oh my God, everyone likes to dance. They like the Rocky Horror Picture Show.
No, no.
Everybody likes to dance.
That's what they do.
Yeah. Well, desperate, Eddie asked his ex-girlfriend's brother, Andy, if he knew of any work. Andy fatefully introduced Eddie to Robin Gecht. And that solidified the Ripper crew lineup.
Yeah, because now you got two lumpy goons.
Right.
You got a skinny goon, and then you got yourself, because he viewed himself as the sex symbol.
Yes. Now, at this point, Robin Gecht was 30 years old and
wow.
The boss. He was the older authority figure.
He's a little older than I expected him to be.
Yeah. Eddie was 21 and highly vulnerable, while Tommy and Andy were just teenagers when they came under the sway of a surprisingly charismatic Svengali.
See, oh, this is gross, though. Just 30 years old, just hanging out with a goon teenager.
Honestly, they all say the same thing. They call him a Svengali.
Oh,
like,
please.
What was his charisma that brought him in? It's like, no, they were all just dumber and shittier than him. And he looked impressive to them.
Of
but
course.
Even then, he's Terry the Gnome if he was a human being.
You still gotta have a little bit of charisma to sway the dullards.
I think you just need to be paying them money to be hanging out with you. You're their boss.
Right.
So they're like, whatever Robin says, that's what we gotta do. Because they're fucking morons.
Right.
And mean, obviously, and truly just brutal assholes.
All very
and then Robin Gecht knew that, and he's just been like, I'm gonna teach these kids a thing or two about a thing or two. And then it just becomes, it's all about touching and breasts with knives.
And one person's charm is just another person's turn off. So I don't think that this guy was charming.
You know how many people
truly
consider me extremely charming?
Charming?
Yeah.
No, he can. He can sing and dance. I've seen him put on shows.
He can sing.
I've seen him do it. He's pathetic.
Oh, I'm a winner.
He got
always a winner.
We sucked him right up, though, and we put him right in that chair, and all you can do is talk now.
Well, I would actually argue.
You could break the picket line.
No, I'm not going to be scammed.
You could. But I would argue, though, that Henry, you're more charismatic than charming. And
yeah,
I am
a Svengali.
And I would say the same thing about Robin Gecht. He wasn't charming at all.
So you're going to say, oh, that's me and him. That's how we're alike.
Yeah.
I am charismatic, able, strong, always hard.
Yep,
I am farsighted.
5'7".
Blood pressure lowered. Can sing, dance, triple threat, right? Been around.
Farsighted means you can't see close to you.
Farsighted means I can actually see farts in the air.
Dude, I would love to see when someone farted and be like, know what you did. Then you have leverage. It's all about leverage.
Leverage.
Well,
it's all about leverage.
Every time I love it. Well, most people compare Robin Gecht to Charles Manson because both allegedly used their influence to inspire brutal murders. Allegedly. That, however, is not a correct reading. Charles Manson was a bait-and-switch cult leader.
He was charming.
Yeah, he was charming, and he was a bait-and-switcher. He ultimately just wanted to convince a bunch of 18-year-old girls to leave behind the groovy Los Angeles hippie lifestyle of 1968 to go live in Death Valley where they could ride dune buggies all day.
Do you remember we had that, well, it's top secret where we got this information from, but we had an inside line who was a very close, quote-unquote, vague, a friend, pen pal of Charles Manson, and talked about that, about the cult of Charles Manson was very much just into as much pussy as he could consume.
Yeah,
and they do say that Tex Watson, I don't think there's a Tex in this story, was truly a great manipulator and has his own cult in prison.
Yes, Robin Gecht is the two to combine.
He's Tombo, okay.
But Robin Gecht, he's more of a bullying manipulator.
Yeah.
He found three young men who were highly suggestible, and if we're being honest, they were not in any way what you'd call bright.
I think we've established they're really stupid.
Yeah. They were medically dumb.
Yeah, Tommy Kokorelis had an IQ of 77.
Yeah. And if you listen to him talk, he is definitely spinny.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? He absolutely is. Yeah. But again, there's something about somebody of that mind where he's also like, I got nothing to do with this. I didn't do anything. I didn't say anything. I wasn't involved in anything. And you watch and perfect, he's Thorazine out of his mind.
Yeah.
Right.
And he's just trying to not. Meanwhile, you're like, no, you did, though. You certainly did.
Yeah, you definitely did. Well, additionally, besides being a group of dullards. Robin,
oh, yeah. I like how you put this here, though. Oh. That it's low. His IQ was low.
Yeah. He's like, well, the thing is. Well, the thing is about Tommy is that his IQ is low enough to put him in like the mildly mentally challenged category, but it's still high enough where he could get a driver's license.
Oh, that's good. I'm happy to know that.
Yeah. I wish.
That explains a lot, actually.
Yeah. Yes, it does.
A lot of those on the road.
There are.
But besides being a group of dullards, Robin and his crew were all relatively short, scrawny guys.
Scrawny.
Although not terribly short. We're not talking David Miscavige short here.
Well, okay. David Miscavige is tiny.
Yeah, he's tiny. Yeah he's they're petite. Just short. I mean, Robin was, as Henry said, he was the big man of the group. He was 5'7", weighed 125 pounds.
I got fucking 50 pounds on Robin Gecht.
You that do?
I'm a fucking bruiser compared to Robin Gecht.
That is extremely small.
Yeah. Very slight. Yeah, it's almost reason why he took four men for them to attack one woman at a time.
Yeah. Yeah. I wonder if that's also part of the psyche where he's like, I'm a man.
No, he's a little bitch.
I'm not a woman. Exactly. I'm a man.
And he's still in jail and he acts like he hasn't done anything.
Yeah. And no, it definitely was like a small group of pixies or gnomes or neckers.
It's Terry the gnome.
Yeah, they're all attacking all at the same time. Jeez. They're all these tiny, weird little guys.
Oh, that's horrible.
Yeah.
Normally you just see those guys in a band, like in a cover band.
Yeah, usually. Oh, yeah. That's a great way to bet. That's where you should be.
Yeah, Chicago Rippers.
Exactly.
Now, as far as the right-hand man and the Ripper crew went, Eddie Spretzer said that he hated who he became when he was around Robin.
This isn't me. This is nothing like me.
Uh-huh.
But even before Robin and Eddie hooked up, Eddie was known to be a disturbing individual.
I just was different. I was different to a lot of different people.
Sounds like
it. But a lot of other people would say that's unique.
Mm-hmm.
When Robin, bad stuff.
Bad guy.
Well, for example, a guy who knew Eddie from high school said that...
Ugh, yeah, I smell the smoked turkey from here. Huh?
Sorry. I just had a lot of turkey. Well, for example, a guy who knew Eddie from high school said that Spretzer showed up to prom with his mouth covered in blood, but instead of wiping it off, he enjoyed how much it shocked everyone, and he spent all night bragging that he'd just come to prom after slaughtering animals in the woods for quote-unquote rituals.
Kind of cool.
You know?
I mean, that's kind of fun.
That's where he did the thing. He's like, again, that time, different me. Prom brought horrible things out
prom
of me.
Prom is stressful.
There are many things that I can't even be associated with more just because of what they bring out of me. Malt chops can't go because I hate to share. I get enraged. I start chopping breasts.
Oh,
I can't,
well,
I can't
don't do that.
Even put me near a Monopoly game.
No.
Because next thing I know, you got all the railroads? Guess what? I'm tying you up in a van. I hate myself when I'm
shopping
playing Monopoly.
Breasts, yeah.
Now, who knows if the prom story is true or not? Because the true crime paperbacks of the 80s and 90s, they're filled with stories from high school classmates who always have a fucked up story to tell about the killers.
Mm-hmm. Or then the thing you thought was super funny back in the day, and now that he's one of the Chicago Ripper crew, you're like, oh, well, actually, now it's kind of gross.
Yeah.
Revisionist history.
But either way, the fact that it sounds like it could be true certainly tells you that Eddie was at the very least disturbed when he met Robin Gecht during a vulnerable and directionless period in his life.
Mm-hmm.
Additionally, if Eddie hated it so fucking much, keep in mind that he could have stopped Robin at any point once the killing began, either by going to the cops or even if he wanted to avoid jail, just kill Robin yourself. If you're going to kill women, why not kill the guy who kills the women and then you won't have to kill the women anymore?
Oh, well, just go to the police.
Yeah, it's interesting because we talk about, Paul Bernardo and we talk about Carla Homolka and how she, in a way, we now know that we believe that Carla Homolka was way more involved and she kind of like, she protested too much about how she was so afraid of Paul. I do believe that she did think she was next and part of why she ended up flipping on him in the very end. But when it comes to victims being with somebody for a long time, we you could see why. Like, if you're trapped in a truly abusive scenario, it really can truly feel impossible to get out. And also sure. The statistics. We know that the most dangerous time in an abusive relationship is when someone tries to exit. That's normally when things really flare up and things go bad. But when you are one of the other murderers,
yeah.
You kind of, for me, you lose a lot of the argument I was a different person then.
He wasn't his fucking boyfriend.
Yeah.
But he was his boss at a part-time job.
Yeah, you just quit.
Yeah, you just leave.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's not that difficult. I'll quit right now. I fucking quit.
Cool.
I'm back.
Whoa, incredible. Yep. Whoa, and this is their new reunion episode.
Wow. Oh, awesome. I've also changed a lot, guys.
Yeah.
Yeah, I have.
Yeah, so how, in what way? In what way? Improv, then.
Jerry doesn't come when I call him anymore.
That's actually really sad.
Yeah, that would be sad. He just started a week ago.
That's nice.
It's Jerry! He came.
Did it happen?
Don't do it.
In your fucking face.
Can I ask you, has it happened more than once?
Yes, multiple times.
Oh, okay,
well, he's
doing it. And I do a little thing with my fingers. I go, whoop, come on in.
That's incredible.
Yeah. That's great.
His brain is now the size of a small peanut. Or no, probably a little bit of a, ooh, a little tennis table.
Ping pong ball.
Thank you.
Jesus.
It's funny that you came up with the words table tennis before you came up with ping pong. That's the name of the game.
I don't want to know. I don't want to know. I don't want to know the switchbacks of his thought process.
Live from your grave.
Well, when Eddie Spretzer was asked about this period of vulnerability when he met Robin, Eddie, of course, didn't take responsibility. Hmm. He said, quote,
"If someone had asked me at the time to be in porno movies or rob a bank or anything, I sure would have done it."
Yeah, that's totally different. I mean,
but again, I was a different guy.
A guy
said, "Hey, do you want to play for the New York Mets?" I'm like, "Yeah."
Yeah.
Yeah. If a guy said, "Hey, man, do you want to be on television? Do you want to be this new? It's called MacGyver. Do you want to be MacGyver on this television show?" Absolutely. I'll take time away from what I'm doing here at the electronics business, and okay, I will go and do that. Yes. Cut off a pair of tits? Absolutely.
Yeah. Okay. Well, that's where you really want to say no.
Now, as opposed to the vast majority of serial killers who begin their experimentation phases outside of the home, doing it to strangers, Robin Gecht went against type and first tortured his wife, which is doubly strange. Contrary to what you might assume, most married serial killers aren't physically abusive towards their wives.
Yeah, it's part of their cover story a lot of the times. It's some other weird game of they get to live a normal life and then have their secret ex life.
Yeah.
Right.
Robin, however, did not follow that pattern. And I'm going to state that from this moment forward, this series is going to be heavy, possibly even laser focused on the act of breast mutilation.
I don't like it.
I don't like it either.
For you guys, because we get a lot of letters, especially when it comes to animal violence. Right? Mm-hmm. A lot of people are really upset. They don't like animal violence.
There's going to be some of that in this episode.
People get really mad. Great. And there's also some people get really upset about baby violence. Right, yeah, people saying bad things. If you throw a baby out of a car, they get mad.
If you choke
a baby with a bunch of rags, they get really
mad.
That
would be very sad to do. When
stick a head of a baby in a paper
shredder.
There's
a series of things you could do.
Everybody gets
don't
upset.
Like it.
I'm really, I'm upset about the breast violence.
Yeah.
So this is your gold star episode.
I'm offended at your content. Because, again, I think breasts are the most pure, wonderful thing that bring us all together as a human family.
They do.
Absolutely.
They really are. It's universal.
Fantastic.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Going through a bit of a breast disance.
Are you? Right. Oh, yeah. We've been talking about this.
Yeah, we've been talking about
great.
It.
That's
great. Yeah, it's nice.
I never left.
Okay, there you go.
But I'm adding butts because I'm growing older.
Nice. Oh, my
That's
goodness.
Nice. Absolutely.
Sometimes I'll just look at a picture of a butt, too.
Congratulations on growth.
I mean, it's maturity.
Absolutely. Everything's a pillow if you look at it like you're tired.
It's like if everything looks like a hammer.
Everything's a nail if you're a hammer.
That's nice. Now, it's interesting that the moment in which Robin began exuberantly marching towards serial killer behavior is also the exact moment that he began bringing Eddie Spetzer into the fold.
Hmm.
See, after Eddie worked for Robin for only 5 months, Eddie went to Robin's house to find that Robin had cut off his wife's nipples.
What?
And had simply left her there to bleed.
It's really, this is
God.
Very fucked up.
Yeah. No, the domestic violence against Rosemary is the worst I've ever heard of.
And he slowly built up. I feel like, we see people ramp up, we see serial killers ramp up their violence as they go. But normally it's outside, we talk about this, but it's outside of the home. It's weird because it felt like he was getting truly comfortable with the violence with his family first.
Yeah. Mm. Well, Eddie took her to the hospital, but before he could talk to the cops, Robin intercepted and told him that the crime could just as easily be pinned on Eddie.
That does not even make sense. That's what you say to a moron.
Right.
Well, I mean, if there's one thing Robin Gecht was good at, it was stone-faced lying. Robin also told Eddie that if he went to the cops, he'd show them pictures of Eddie and Rosemary having sex. Although I'm not sure if Eddie ever actually had sex with Rosemary.
I don't know. Got a spam email. That was just like, we've hacked into your accounts and we have nude pictures of you in the bathroom. My mom called me fucking hysterical. Mm. Be like, how did they get nude pictures of me? Well, how did they see me nude? Henry Thomas. This is like, you know, 11 a.m. Yeah. And I was like,
I don't know.
What are you talking about? She's like, they sent an email and they had pictures of my breasts. And I was like, that's not possible. So again, this is how you lie to someone who doesn't know.
It is interesting how you shoehorn that story in. Fernando brought up on Top Hat, a Roomba did take a picture of a chick taking a dump and put it online. So your mom, if your mom has a Roomba, your mom might be, honestly, if that does happen.
I don't know. I let it see.
I might have to pull a Tom Green and just paint your side of your house. If there is a picture of your mom naked, of your mother naked.
No, we can't have a Roomba because it scares Wendy.
Yeah, I it's weird.
I don't enjoy them.
No.
I wish I had a little robot pet. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, the thing is that Eddie maintained that the only sexual contact he had with Rosemary was the one time he applied lotion to her breasts while she was sunbathing topless.
What is it, Summer Rental with John Candy?
It's 1979, man. Like, shit's different.
It's so interesting for Robin to do this crime, and then he's just like, you know, I have pictures of her, you know, having sex together, and I'm going to do something. I'm going to show the world about this. And then Eddie's just like, you know, the only time was the one time I just massaged your wife's breasts before she was sunbathing topless. And you could just see Robin going, you did what?
mean,
I was lying. I cut those nipples off. I did that. We know that. Yeah. I was lying.
Right.
And so, faced with all the trouble Robin promised, Eddie not only agreed to keep the secret, but he also continued to work with Robin professionally. He'd only been there for 5 months.
Jesus. What did the doctor say? Where'd your nipples go? Did you fall down? What? I mean, don't the doctors be like, they don't usually fall off.
They just did that.
Yeah. Well, most likely, even with the blackmail, I think Eddie stuck around hoping that he might be included in a little of the old ultraviolence later on.
He liked it. He liked it immediately.
Now, we're going to have a couple of big jumps in this story. Ben, you're already asking questions. And I'm not necessarily, because you're saying, like, what did the cops do when the woman showed up with no nipples?
What did the cops do when the woman showed up with no nipples?
I don't fucking know. The book's not that well written.
No, it's not.
Does it come with two plastic nipples?
We did a lot of, yeah, honestly, those were incredible.
Yeah.
Because it's just nice to see what other kinds would look like on
there. Isn't that fun?
And Robin himself never confessed to any of his crimes. And the people who did confess to the crimes are fucking morons.
Right.
And then half lying and we don't know what's up or what's down. But I also wonder if it comes down to just straight up domestic violence at the time. She did not want to press charges, if she didn't want to, they might not have even just showed up. You might have just been like, because even she talks about how his obsession with her breasts got and hurting her breasts kept rising and getting bigger and bigger and bigger. And he was like, I want to see how they work. I want to see the inside of them and stuff.
Nothing tough, masculine, cool, whatever about domestic violence. You're a pussy and a bitch.
Yeah.
And if you are in there, it's very tough.
Yes.
And hopefully there's some resources out there to get you out.
Let's hope so. But what we do know is that after Robin cut off his wife's nipples, a steady stream of teenage girls began flowing through his house. These girls would party all night. Sometimes they'd refuse to leave. But Rosemary was, of course, too terrified to protest.
Right. So this is your Dean Corll kind of crossover.
It's really weird because no one wanted to see. He's just inviting like children over to hang out in the house and fuck and party and do all this kind of stuff.
Right.
And no one's like saying anything. They're just kind of letting it rock. I think because they're already very scared of him.
Weird. Yeah.
But perhaps seeking to take this decadent lifestyle even further into the realm of the sadistic, Robin began customizing his roomy red Dodge work van to turn it into a mobile chamber of horrors designed specifically to commit torture murders.
Well, the problem here is exhibit with the Pimp Your Ride. We have an application. This guy says that he's going to want to make it a torture bus.
Yeah, we put a torture bus in your torture bus so you can torture bus while you torture bus.
There you go.
In addition,
had to. I had to complete the exhibit. He did this to me. I had to complete the meme.
In addition, his behavior in his personal life was also descending into the depths of decadence. Mm. Cutting the nipples off was only the beginning. See, while Robin was married to Rosemary, he also had a girlfriend named Tina, who had quite a bit to say about Robin's lifestyle leading up to the murders. While they were together, for example, Robin was accused of raping a 15-year-old girl at gunpoint. Jesus. And Tina said he always had a wide variety of pills at his disposal that he would freely hand out, if not force on others.
And that would become his MO.
Yeah. Tina also said that Robin was obsessed with Elvis and had amassed a huge collection of records, coffee cups, pictures, and other memorabilia that no one was allowed to touch but him.
That's a true crossover star.
Do not bring Elvis into this. King of Graceland.
Again, that's how big he was.
Yeah, that's true.
When Tina asked Robin if he believed in God, he allegedly said, quote,
I only believe in two things, myself and Elvis Presley.
What the fuck is that?
But while Robin's obsession with Elvis was indeed strong, it paled in comparison to how much Robin was obsessed with large breasts, to the point where I would say that Robin, he was haunted by his obsession with large breasts.
You live in the Midwest. You can find them. I don't is what the Midwest is.
But yeah. It's craven, weird, childish in its obsession. And then what we talk about a lot in this, where there's something about the people that do these extreme crimes have this sort of a childlike, it's an immaturity that is diabolical.
Right.
You know, like because scary. It's scary because it really is surface level, obsessed, wanting, like, because one thing Keaton was mind was that he had read stories about quote unquote like uncultured civilizations using breasts as like bags, like using literally like using them as like fucking, they would tan them and use them as like holding bag
as
and
totes.
He was, like, as totes, and he was like obsessed with shit like that. It's like, I don't know, because I like boobies, but I like them on a woman.
Yeah,
no blood on the inside. Blood could be on the inside. And then I like it nice. I like it to be friendly. I like everyone to be happy with showing the boobs.
I like happy boobies.
I like happy boobies. I like happy,
where everyone's happy. Mm. It's all happy.
We're all
they
smiling,
look happy.
You know, like I have huge tits.
Yeah.
Real nice melons on you there. And of course, the booby purse is brought to you by Boobalingsia. Boobalingsia.
Boobalingsia.
Boobalingsia.
Is that a new, Fernando, is that one of the new ads?
Belsienga.
We have Boobalingsia. Is that the new like?
Boobalingsia.
Oh,
Balenciaga.
We are not advertised by Balenciaga.
No, we are not.
Well, this infatuation with large breasts, Robin said he explained it away by saying that it was genetic.
Sure.
He said, quote,
it's a thing with my entire family going back as I'm told to my great-grandfather. Each of us men have married large-breasted women. My ex-wife is a 39D, and yes, she was very satisfying to me.
Well, okay. Why? Well, then, okay, go on.
He was just saying, it is weird. No,
but then
no.
Why does he hurt them? Because
he's fucked up.
Yeah.
Right.
And what was more, Robin was also obsessed with how breasts worked. When his girlfriend Tina became pregnant with Robin's third, fourth, maybe fifth child, Robin insisted that she let him watch her breastfeed after the baby was born so he could, quote, see how the milk flowed into the breast.
See, I don't know how that works. I don't know how it works from the back, but like we kind of talked about it. But like it is, you know, when you go out to dinner with someone's got a baby and it's nice.
You've talked
you know
about it.
Mean?
We haven't talked about you it.
They, you know, if they just snap out the boobies, they snap them out like and they feed the baby. I know that that's societally correct and fine. That's normal,
totally.
Healthy, natural.
Absolutely.
And
then
I'm not allowed to look.
Yeah, no, you're not supposed to stare. No, you do
you're not supposed to stare. You're supposed to be.
No, I'm not staring, but I look up. I wear sunglasses. I wear sunglasses.
You know,
that's
actually
creepy.
Treat it, you know, you do
creepy?
It. You treat it like a salt shaker. When you see it when you're at dinner, do you stop and stare at the salt shaker? Do you notice the salt shaker?
Yeah, the salt shaker's not open female breasts.
No,
it is different. It is different indeed, Henry. Yes, it is different. And then Henry does a mental face swap between he and the baby. And it's just Henry's face on the baby.
Oh, yeah.
Well, Tina said that for the longest time, all that Robin would talk about was breasts.
I don't
breast
always look.
I know, we know. You don't always look.
I don't.
You wow. don't always look. You don't make anyone uncomfortable.
I never
you're just,
do.
Protest. You're just saying that it's hard to ignore.
Yes.
Protest too much indeed.
I think so. I tried fun. Moving on. And
we did.
You just, are not. You're
it's
not
a letting. Whole troubling episode. And,
yeah.
And we're already making jokes.
Sure.
Well, Tina said that for the longest time, all he would talk about was breast this and breast that. But of course, these conversations would take dark turns.
Yes.
Yeah,
to that point, Robin was always after Tina to cut off her own nipples so he could see what was inside. He told her that sex workers did it for him all the time. What's the big deal?
They cut off their nipples.
They cut
for
off
him?
Their nipples.
No,
all the
they
time.
Didn't. I
they
mean,
did it
they
all
just
the
don't.
Time. He
no,
said they
don't.
Did it all the time.
And no, they don't fucking grow back.
And he said if Tina wouldn't do it for him, he'd find someone who would, which is a contradiction because he just said that these sex workers cut off their nipples all the time for him.
Okay. I don't think he's arguing in good faith.
I don't think so either.
Well, as far as where Robin wanted to have sex, it seems like he was taking his customized torture van for test drives of a sort with Tina, both in the coital fashion and in the torture fashion. When they'd have sex in the van, as was Robin's preference, he'd chase her around and stick pins in her breasts because inflicting pain was the only way Robin could become turgid.
It really did. He had to inflict pain to feel sexual involvement.
On other people. I'm like, if he wants to stick himself,
you
whatever.
You do whatever you want. And again, if someone likes it, then you do it.
Yeah.
But not if they don't like it.
Yeah, the old pin cushion there. That is not good.
No. Well, his wife got it the worst. Oh. Tina said that one time she went over to Robin and Rosemary's house and noticed that Rosemary was pale and sweaty. When Tina asked her what was wrong, Rosemary lifted her blouse to show that Robin had stuck 6 hat pins into her breasts. Rosemary said that Robin refused to let her remove them until he said so. He'd injected Novocaine into her breasts so the pain would be bearable enough for her to go about her day. But nevertheless, the wounds still bled constantly.
Horrible.
Now, naturally, Rosemary was terrified of Robin to the point where she would actually confide. She was confiding in her husband's girlfriend.
Yeah.
Because she had no one else to talk to.
Well, he cut them off entirely. He cut the whole world off inside of this house. It really was. Oof. This is a world of nightmares.
Yeah.
Besides the further breast mutilation, like lighting her breasts on fire after dousing them with lighter fluid, he would do extreme breast bondage. Robin also involved her in humiliating bestiality and animal cruelty.
Dude, this is toy box killer shit.
Oh, dude.
Well,
this is one of the...
It's a different kind of bestiality.
This is one of the... Ugh. I want to say, this little section is one of the worst stories I've heard almost in our entire show.
Yeah. Also, why did you pitch that like a cult leader? It's a different kind of bestiality.
You know?
We're not like that anymore. No, it's a different kind of bestiality.
Yeah, it feels like crypto.
Curious?
I am not curious.
Well, on one occasion, Robin forced Rosemary to bring her parents' big dog over to their house. And this is what's so strange about it. This is so weird. He made Rosemary bring the dog over so he could have sex with it. Because he wanted to make her watch him have sex with the dog. And to prove that Robin did it, when Rosemary told Tina about it, she had a pair of Robin's underwear that was like covered in dog hair.
Oh my God.
And I just feel that I see Fernando frowning.
Christ.
It really is. I really hope
he's getting beat up right now.
They are in solitary. Yeah. They can't go anywhere.
Ugh. And later, when that dog was about to have puppies, Robin dragged it to the basement, beat it to death with a baseball bat, and cut out the puppies so he could store them in jars of alcohol as a macabre decoration.
And I do want to point out, they were not his. They
you
were
can
not
tell.
His.
It's the hair color.
I knew that we just went right from like he fucked it, and then when it was ready to have puppies,
yeah,
there must have been something else.
I never thought I could act this way. I've got to say, I just don't get it.
R.I.P. Gordon.
I don't know how we're wrong, but
what a tribute episode to Gordon Lightfoot.
It really is. This is about the Gordon Lightfoot family.
Yeah.
And speaking of dead bodies, Robin would brag to Tina that he'd figured out a foolproof way to dispose of a body. He said that all you had to do was take the body to a cemetery where they'd already dug a grave. You go the night before a funeral.
So then
you throw the body into the hole and cover the corpse with dirt. Then the next day, the casket would be lowered on top of the victim.
Oh, yeah. Wow.
And then the body would disappear forever.
And that recall right there, that's to bury someone. It's called a sale. Come on.
It's the single stupidest
idea. The dumbest thing.
And he's like, that's smart. Wow.
That right there, that's why I'm the leader.
This is what is so scary about all of it. All the work, all the self-improvement, everything we try to do as a people, and then it's just morons.
Yes, yeah. Truly. Well,
it's all
again,
fucking Stephen Paddocks out there.
Dumb and mean is a truly powerful combination.
That is true.
Because you don't care. Because if you are truly a fucking moron, you do not have very good impulse control. You also cannot understand. Empathy is a learned skill. Empathy is like a thing you really have to sit and think about. You have to understand other people have perspectives. It makes your life super complicated. Like it's not as simple as just everybody's meat walking around if you could do it everything you want to them. Because again, you can make moves on somebody really hard because most people trust other human beings. So the mean quality then also makes you like a truly dangerous because we want to trust other people.
Yeah.
But you know what? It is funny. Sometimes you're mean, but you serve soup all saucy.
And then you're a soup Nazi.
Yeah, it's soup Nazi. Again, that's
we took a picture with the actor that plays him.
He was very intoxicated.
So were we.
But the fact remains that Robin was quite giddy talking about the prospect of getting rid of a body, and he would indeed do something similar with one of the Ripper crew's early victims, and it actually worked. Now, before long, Robin's fantasies of actually killing someone began to inch their way into reality, and he wasn't at all concerned with who saw him doing it, nor was he concerned that anyone was going to turn him into the police. For example, he started building his own primitive torture tools. He built a poker that he constructed by affixing a hat pin to the end of a long broomstick, and he'd use that to chase around Tina, stabbing her, poking her.
Jesus.
And she'd try to throw it away, but every time she threw it away, he'd just make another one.
It's weird, though, right, about how, like, she treated him like he was a child, too. They all kind of danced around him like he was a kid as well, treating this like these weren't serious. I know that they were, and they were very scared, but just being like, I threw away that torture tool of yours, and then he went like, well, I'm going to have to go make another one, like it's his favorite recliner.
Yeah. And I just searched hat pin, and they are quite large.
They're very, very large. Yes. More disturbing, however, were Robin Geck's homemade axes. Again, using a length of broomstick, Robin would embed a thick, triangular piece of glass, making a weapon that was both terrifying in its primitive appearance and surprisingly efficient in its execution. And tragically, that first execution would occur in late May 1981.
3 years after the prosecution of John Wayne Gacy. Mm-hmm. So I think it's keeping us in this world. Remember, like, this is the height of serial killer, like, panic in America.
I wonder if he saw what John Wayne Gacy did, and I wonder if he normalized it, where he's like, that just happens here in Chicago.
It might.
I don't know.
Who knows?
Well, again, we don't know how the idea was first brought up, but starting in 1981, Robin, Eddie, Tommy, and Andy started taking out Robin's red van into Chicago to pick up sex workers to assault, and eventually they would work their way up to murder. See, after cruising around for a while, Robin would spot a sex worker on the street, always choosing a black woman because he presumably knew, just like Jeffrey Dahmer knew, that a black person's death would get a half-hearted investigation at best, especially in the early 80s. At first, Eddie and Andy were the ones who would crawl into the back of the van and stay there just before Robin picked up the potential victim. They'd then wait for two taps from Robin, and at that moment, they'd burst out the back doors and force the sex worker into the back of the van, immediately creating an atmosphere of terror.
Again, it's four on one. It's absolutely horrible. It's horrible.
Just horrible. Yeah.
Usually it was three on one.
Yeah, well, then every once in a while when Eddie would come around.
Yeah. Or every once in a while when Tommy would come around. Well, ironically, considering what eventually happened, Robin would assure Andy and Eddie each time that they wouldn't get in trouble for participating in these crimes. But once it was all said and done, they faced far more charges and were sentenced to far harsher punishments than what Robin ever received.
Really?
Oh, yeah. Well, he flipped on them. And then also there's this angle of whether or not you believe it or not, that he thought that they were doing some form of that. They would get to some form of magic ritual, which is Are they even smart enough for that? We're going to parse that out.
These people don't seem smart enough to even read
a magical book. We're going to parse all that out.
Yeah.
Live from your grave.
Now, the Ripper crew claimed that the murder started before May of 1981, but in the first known murder, Andy and Robin were cruising North Chicago in the torture van when they pulled over and spoke with a sex worker named Linda Sutton, who worked the area around Wrigley Field. After getting into the van, they drove her to a popular spot 30 miles away where sex workers could get the job done for an hourly fee, a place called either the Moonlit Motel or the Rip Van Winkle, depending on the source. I've heard two things.
Rip Van Winkle is a very scary name for a hotel.
Yeah.
Isn't the lore that he was like eating kids?
Yeah, nothing with ripping.
What the fuck is Rip Van Winkle again?
He slept too long.
Still, it sounds like he's dead. It still sounds like I don't want to be in a motel.
It's a place where you sleep
forever.
Didn't he
have some golden hair or some shit?
No, I think it was...
That is Rumpelstiltskin.
I'm thinking Rumpelstiltskin. Rip Van Winkle just slept too long.
He slept too long.
He slept too long, yeah. He slept and he slept and he slept, and when he woke up, he had a big beard, and it was like 200 years later, and he was very sad.
What's the story?
That.
Don't sleep too long.
Don't sleep too
long. Why? He lived.
No, because you miss so much.
Who gives a fuck? What are we missing?
See, very interesting takes on tales.
Yes. But either way, a third member of the Ripper crew, Eddie Spetzer, he was at the motel waiting. This was all pre-planned.
This is like Devil's Rejects.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, Linda immediately recognized that something was wrong here, and she refused to get out of the van. But on Robin's orders, Andy and Eddie forced her out. And while they held her down, Robin punched her in the face until she crumpled down. But instead of taking her into the motel, Robin and Eddie dragged Linda to a field behind the motel, while Andy returned to the van and watched from the front seat. Now, according to Andy's later confession, Eddie held Linda down while Robin raped her. Then Robin pulled out his homemade glass broomstick axe and struck Linda 3 to 4 times in the chest. He then took a length of piano wire and severed Linda's left breast before returning to Andy. The two of them left in the van while Eddie left in his own car, of course leaving the corpse behind in the lonely field behind the Rip Van Winkle, where it would stay until a housekeeper noticed the stench 3 days later.
Oh, do they take the breast as a prize?
We'll get to that here in a bit. Now, even though Linda Sutton's body had been exposed for just a few days, the large wounds inflicted on the chest, in addition to the removal of the breast, had allowed bacteria, parasites, and maggots to break down the tissue at an accelerated rate, giving the appearance that the body had been there for weeks.
Yeah, I was watching some old school, old-fashioned true crime docs about this, and they're all like, mostly parasites enter through the mouth because it's already an open hole, and they search their way through the anus to find their way to the sweet, sweet guts inside. And you're like, all right, buddy.
No.
I know
you're getting too hard on it.
I know you like this. Yeah.
I was watching a thing on when they find bodies, you know, the people that go in and clean up the bodies, and the woman that ran it, she's like, we think those little bugs are like our best employees because it just takes one fly to lay some larva and then they just eat the human flesh. She's like, those are our best employees.
Like, oh, good. That's disgusting. Oh, disgusting. Great.
Yeah, it takes a smile.
The way that she's like, smile. Sometimes there's brain fragments, but they just take care of it. I was like, what are you doing here?
When that person likes their job, I'm fine with it.
I love it. God. Somebody's got to like it.
Yes.
Someone.
Now, to be fair, this was not necessarily a DNI murder, because police did investigate just a little. While the body was near skeletal, the arms were still bound by cheap handcuffs with a broken key still in the lock, which is a detail Andy Cocorelis missed.
Mm.
Additionally, a strip of cloth had been stuffed in the mouth, presumably to muffle any screaming. And while there were no shoes on the body, there were still socks. And stuffed inside those socks was the sum of
$13. Oh, so they take the money.
They didn't, I mean,
because it wasn't a robbery.
They didn't care. And they also probably didn't know that there was $13 in their socks. Now, once detectives couldn't find any missing persons reports that fit the description of the body, they rightfully pegged her as a murdered sex worker, which, as we know, this happened fairly often, very often, extremely often in the 70s and 80s. And eventually she was identified by fingerprints and dental records. But they were somewhat puzzled that she had money, because carrying money made a prostitution charge much more likely should the cops catch a woman in the act. But this is a fun part. Some sex workers had systems in place for getting around such an inevitability.
Okay.
For example, a Chicago legend named Mailbox Marilyn. She would ingeniously carry...
That's my wife.
She would ingeniously carry self-addressed stamped envelopes. And before she performed her services, she'd get paid, take the money, put it in the envelope, and drop it in the mailbox, and then go do the business.
Boom.
Because if she didn't have any money on her and she got caught in the act, she couldn't be charged with prostitution.
Okay.
She'd just get charged with public indecency.
That's there a picture of her right there when she was panhandling on this down the street.
Let's take a look there. Oh,
she looks happy.
Well, you know, a smile can tell a lot, but not necessarily always.
You used to know her as Crazy Mary.
Crazy Mary.
Oh, good for her.
Now, one thing we know about serial killers is that there's usually a pretty extensive cooling off period between the first and second murders. Sometimes it's 6 months, sometimes it's a year, sometimes it's 5 years. And that cooling off period often gets shorter as the killer commits more murders. but the speed in which the Ripper crew moved on to victims 2 and 3 implies that either a group dynamic shortens the cooling off period or that Robin Gecht had been murdering on his own long before he brought Eddie, Tommy, and Andy into the fold.
Is it possible that you just start berserker? After he's been torturing his wife,
every
and maybe
once in a while. He's been living a life of sexual depravity.
True.
So if you have been, and those dudes, they've been joining in. I think that's a part of it.
With
is
Rosemary?
That, maybe other women, other sex workers, all of them kind of slowly. I think he was slowly, in my mind, he was raising them up. He was training them. So the three of them kind of came along with him. Did some stuff, fucked around, and it wasn't until they started. That's the reason why. But they compartmentalized. We're like, well, you know, we weren't murderers until we started doing it. But they had been talking about it and building it up and building it up. Mm-hmm. That's my feeling.
See, just a month after killing Linda Sutton, Eddie and Robin picked up another black woman, a woman who's to this day unidentified. She was a hitchhiker. They gave her some pills.
That was the new MO, was that you give them pills first so they start to get tired and disoriented. Up top.
Yeah.
You can't even do it 3-on-1 natty.
Yes. They have to cheat.
They gave her some pills. They took her to a cemetery, pulled her out of the van, and beat her with a baseball bat. Eddie then returned to the car, but Robin stayed behind. And 5 minutes later, Robin returned with one of the woman's severed breasts.
And this is
That's when he starts taking trophies.
That's when he starts. So the other,
Also, I guess this is the main reason why Chris Evans actually said no to the movie.
Is that right?
Because he said something about this, because a lot of them were like, we gotta leave in the return with the breast scene.
Yeah.
And because he was fighting for that. Chris Evans really wanted it. A lot of the producers fought.
Are they making a movie on this?
No, absolutely not. It's unfilmable. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, about a month after that, Robin was giving Eddie a ride home to pick up his paycheck at Winchell's Donut House, where Eddie worked part-time.
What's with the bakeries? Can we leave the bakeries alone?
I mean, it was just good working for people that need, you know, it's easy training.
Killers and sweets. I'm telling you, man.
You know what's interesting? Winchell's Donut House, there's none in Chicago anymore, but here in L.A., there's 20.
Yeah.
There's 20?
We have an ornamental donut economy.
I have never seen anyone eat a donut here.
I eat donuts
all the fucking time.
You do because you're wasting. Everybody else does it because they're all constantly afraid of sugar.
Yeah.
And anything that could possibly change their body in any way, shape, or form.
I like my yum yum donuts. Give me my yum yum donuts.
Okay, well, that's very weird, but
I just see you covered in blood. I see you sitting outside of the red van.
I just feel like it's like when the Ghostbusters get their first call. They're like, what? The phone's ringing. Like, all of those are just pipelines for fentanyl. Yeah. And you're the only person that ever buys donuts from them.
Oh, you want donuts? And they got to go run out.
What is this, a donut store? Oh, God damn it.
Well, instead of picking up Eddie's paycheck at Winchell's Donut House, the two psychopaths spotted another black woman hitchhiking. So Robin told Eddie to climb back into the rear of the van. The woman was then picked up unaware that there was a guy in the back, and Robin drove her to a forest preserve. When Robin stopped the car in a suitably secluded area, he tapped twice on the floor of the van, signaling Eddie to exit through the back to meet Robin up front with a knife and a pair of handcuffs.
It's like a Texas Chainsaw Massacre where they hit the cane on the ground to get Leatherface.
Yep. This second hitchhiker, also never identified, was handcuffed and led into the woods by Robin alone. And when he returned 5 minutes later, he was again in possession of a severed breast. These trophies, by the way, would be kept in Robin's van on the floor between the seats.
Oh, God, what is that smell?
I mean, it's...
To keep the van from reaching a Randy Kraft level of gore, because remember Randy Kraft's car was quite bloody.
Right.
Robin kept a 5-gallon bucket and some dish soap around to clean up after every murder. Presumably this was because Robin, he was still using the van every day for his business.
Yeah, it was a business expense.
Jesus.
Now, the Ripper crew went almost a year before their next murder, following that 3-month, 3-kill spree in 1981.
Mm.
But when they returned in May of 1982, they killed at least 15 people less than 6 months.
It's horrifying.
And a fair share of them had nothing to do with the sex trade.
And again, you really see, it's interesting that there has been so little coverage. As we were doing this episode, we have the book. But even the book, as we said, it's spotty at best. And we were putting together like whatever court transcripts we could find, all that kind of information, putting it all together. And it's just crazy to think like they really were terrifying Chicago for a year and no one did anything.
I'd argue against it. No one knew it was happening.
I guess they just didn't talk about it.
They didn't talk about it. And we'll talk in the next episode. We'll begin the next episode as to partly why it wasn't talked about. The other story that was kind of taking all the oxygen out of the room.
What they said was.
Okay, but there was another big true crime story taking the oxygen out of the room.
It was the curse of the Cubs.
Yeah. But the thing
they
was,
were really concerned with the Cubs.
Yeah, that goat should have been let in.
But they were also, you know, they were hiding the bodies fairly well most of the time. Their fourth murder.
There's four people working on it.
Yeah.
So it's not like it's one guy doing the action and then you deal with the fallout after you've done it. And like, it's like you got a team of guys working to hide.
But it's also four people and any moment one of them could have been like, this ain't right.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Their fourth murder, it wasn't connected to the Ripper crew at all until Eddie Spretzer later confessed to everything because the police had no body until Eddie told them where it was. At this point, this fourth murder, the police thought it was a missing persons case. They had this woman just disappeared.
That happens. They just disappear.
Now, details are scant, but from what we can piece together, Robin, Eddie, and Tommy, and this was Tommy's first time out, by the way.
Oh, okay.
They saw 21-year-old Lorraine Borowski walking to her job as a secretary at a local RE/MAX real estate office at 8:30 a.m. in the wealthy Chicago suburb of Elmhurst. After following her into her office, where she was the first to arrive that day, the Ripper crew grabbed her and dragged her to the van, then took her to a nearby motel, where a gag was stuffed in her mouth and the beating began. Now, while Eddie claimed to have been nothing more than a voyeur up to this point, Tommy said that both Robin and Eddie raped her before Eddie took out a 3-foot length of piano wire. It was wrapped around Lorraine's breast and tightened until the appendage was severed. Taking the depravity even further, Eddie and Robin then had sex with the wound in Lorraine's chest.
God.
Then Robin used his glass axe to finish the job. The body was then taken to a cemetery in Clarendon Hills where the Ripper crew hid the remains in a mausoleum and the corpse would stay there until Eddie told the police where to look.
But it was really scary. Yuck. The way she was yanked off the street was also extremely terrifying.
Well, she was yanked out of her office.
Yeah, like she was already, it's technically like safe, right? And they went and got her. And this is where the Ripper name comes from. One of the reasons why it hasn't really been covered that much is because every one of these crimes involved this form of mutilation.
Yes, and it gets even worse from here. Now, on the day of the kidnapping and murder of Lorraine Borowski, it was obvious to her boss when he walked in that something terrible had happened in the office. Lorraine's shoes were on the floor, cosmetics were strewn about the office, her keys were left behind, and police questioned nearby business owners. And in fact, one store owner in the same shopping plaza had a vague memory of a reddish-orange van parked in an area of the parking lot that was normally empty.
And that was the very first seed of anybody knowing who these guys were.
Yeah. Hmm. Now, that was a solid lead because it was indeed the van that the Ripper crew drove. But instead of following that trail, the cops listened to the guy who owned the nearby liquor store because he said that he had seen Lorraine that morning getting into a car. He said, "I saw Lorraine. She got into a car. The car drove off. But I can't remember what kind of car it was."
All ridiculous.
I know is that it's a car.
Was and he, like, was he sipping on his own supply?
I don't know, but she was literally taken out of her own shoes. Yeah. She didn't get into a car.
Yeah. So the detective on the case brought in another detective who also happened to be a certified hypnotist.
Now what's going on here?
This guy, you know, some guys have multi skills, you know, but it is strange. It's kind of scary if you met a detective that was also a hypnotist.
It does
feel like a television show.
Yeah, it does.
It does. I just watched your Murder, She Wrote episode, which I always catch the new episodes. And the hypnotist did it by hypnotizing somebody to kill.
That's cool.
It was cool.
I love Murder, She Wrote.
Oh, it's the best show ever.
It's wonderful.
Now, I wish it was Murder, She Writes, because then it'd be more present.
It would be, wouldn't it now? Hmm. But she is. Not dead. Angela Lansbury is still with us.
Yes, she is. Is she?
Yeah, no, I think so.
She's recently dead.
I think she died last year.
No, I just watched her new show.
Pretty sure she died last year.
I just watched her new show yesterday.
Yeah, she died on October 11th of, she died.
She died last year.
She was pulled apart by a bunch of golden retrievers.
Oh, no kidding.
That's unbelievable. Yeah. I can't believe they put up corpse pictures.
Yeah. Mystery solved.
Yeah. New show. I think Murder, She Wrote ended in 1994.
It's new to me,
but it's new to him.
Well, This hypnotist came in, and after supposedly digging into the liquor store owner's subconscious...
Deeper, deeper.
Oh my God, get out of here.
The detective was told that Lorraine Borowski had definitely gotten into a sports car. Either a Thunderbird or a Cougar.
She was just so excited that she was like, I've got to go. She was like, she kicked her shoes off. She threw her stuff everywhere. Yeah. I got to get in that car.
She's rolling out to America's greatest diners, drive-ins, and dives.
No, I mean, a Thunderbird is the exact opposite of a red Dodge van.
Yeah, it's no, this guy really fucked it up.
It
yeah.
didn't help.
Yeah. Well, the investigation went nowhere because they didn't follow the
record. You got to understand the nice thing about this guy is that he helped me quit smoking. That's what I love.
So yes, he did derail an investigation that could have saved multiple lives.
Listen,
but
he's got my wife barking like a dog every time it's her birthday.
There you go.
I love this guy.
Yeah, hypnotism, huh?
But even though the Ripper crew had taken a year between murders 3 and 4, murders 5 through 20 would occur in a short 6-month period that was barely covered by the press.
Holy shit.
In addition, the crew themselves would begin dabbling in rituals and cannibalism. And that's where we'll pick back up next time for the conclusion to our series on the Chicago Rippers.
Hey, man,
great.
This is some old school heavy hitter territory. It's been a long time since we've been here.
Yeah.
Sometimes I do flash back to like a 2014 version of what I would say.
Yeah.
And it's kind of, but it's crazy. This crime series got no coverage, really.
None.
As you could see why. It's a bit difficult.
Yeah, but you know, that's why it needs to be fucking covered.
That's what we say.
Well, I mean, it was every once in a while, like when I was Googling a couple of stories on it.
Satanic murderers comes up.
Satanic murderers always comes up.
I don't think they're smart enough to be satanic murderers.
We'll get to it. But you know, there is every once in a while, like a Chicago station will say, like, you know, the infamous Chicago Rippers. You know, the infamous
Man
story.
Cow.
Yeah. Like,
yeah.
Man Cow.
Man Cow in the morning. Welcome to Man Cow in the morning, folks. I'm not woke. Chicago Rippers were right.
Oh, no.
And
that would be, that would really, you'd lose some advertisers.
You would.
You may be. All right. Well, thank you all so much for listening. Hope you are surviving. Do we have anything to say? Let's see. So we got our comic book
on the left.
Spring Hill Jack coffee. Go get some.
Yeah, Z2comics.com. Get the comic book Spring Hill Jack coffee. We got a new coffee line coming out very soon. We've been talking about it. We are working on the art right now.
T-shirts. Go to lastpodcastmerch.com. Many more things than just t-shirts. We have a whole merch store there. Lots of merch. We're merch people.
If you're naked, you can get fully clothed.
You can get fully clothed. Clothed there. And just keep supporting all the shows
and then
here on the
network.
If
you want to come and see us in Australia, we have it Wednesday, August 2nd, Auckland, New Zealand. August 4th, Adelaide, Australia. August 6th, Brisbane. August 7th, Melbourne. August 10th, Sydney. And August 12th, Perth. We're going to come see you fucking weirdos on the other side of the goddamn planet.
Unfortunately, the Cherry Tavern is closed, so don't get your cocaine fix or your sticky floor fix.
I've heard
it's not happening anymore.
I heard it moved.
It moved, but the OG is closed.
Yeah. And No Dogs in Space, Season 3, premiering on May 18th.
Yeah!
Ooh, who are you covering?
Covering the monks, my friend. You'll love them. I'll get into it.
You like the monks.
I love them.
You'll get into it. You'll love it.
I love the monks.
You love the monks. You've heard the monks. I've forced you to listen to the monks before, and you said you liked it.
I love it. All right, everyone. Thank you for listening. Hail yourselves.
Hail Satan.
Hail Gain.
Because the lesson.
Nail me, child. See the child. Sweet baby girl, child.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Man, I've been watching a lot of this fucking. I'm sorry. I'll get into it.
All right.
It's a 67-year-old and a 25-year-old. And they're celebrating.
Dating.
They're having OnlyFans account.
Yeah.
They have an OnlyFans
account
together.
Yeah. It's a whole thing.
And they don't do anal because she's got problems with her back. She's got problems with her butt.
With her butt. She has.
She's 67 years old.
I also can't do anal.
Let's move on.
I can't put the bleeding anus. Can't put anything up.
This show is made possible by listeners like you. Thanks to our ad sponsors, you can support our shows by supporting them. For more shows like the one you just listened to, go to lastpodcastnetwork.com.